Hey everyone, you're listening to On Their Behalf, formerly known as DNA, a True Crime Podcast. Please enjoy.
So, would you rather be Carol Baskins or the Tiger King? Have you watched the show?
Yes, of course. Okay. I've watched it.
Okay, good.
Oh my god.
I wasn't sure. I was like, wait, I'm gonna ask her this and she might not actually know.
Okay. I almost don't want to answer that because now they're investigating her and I am like, because right now I'd rather be Carol fucking Baskin.
Yeah.
Because she's out there living her life.
Exactly.
I don't know how that's gonna turn out because I feel like they're gonna find some shit and it's not gonna end well. You know who I wanna be? I wanna be Doc Antle. Just have like tigers and babes around all the time.
Yeah. Same.
No, for real. Everyone is a monster.
Oh god, it's weird, such a
terrible
weird
abuse going on of humans and animals.
Yeah,
don't condone it.
That's why I didn't
condone watching Tiger King.
Yes, I didn't want to watch it at first because I was afraid I was gonna see animal cruelty, and I was like, I don't think I can force myself to sit down and watch somebody abuse a tiger, so I'm not watching it. And then a couple friends were like, no, you don't see, like, it's implied obviously because
right
there has to be,
but they
don't
also know their audience that they're not gonna like.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they don't actually show anything happening.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why I'm like, everyone is saying watch Don't Fuck with Cats, but I'm like, I don't want to watch videos of like cats being murdered.
No, no.
Hey, is it murder if it's not a human? Long silence.
Yeah,
I don't think it is.
I don't know.
Like, you wouldn't be, if you killed a cat, you wouldn't be tried for murder.
No.
But you, like, might get 3 years for animal abuse or something.
Yeah. So then, let's do, like, another question is, do you really think she killed her husband?
Okay. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, me too.
But you know what? I don't blame her, because I feel like that was not a good situation.
No, I don't either, but I'd never feel
I don't
like,
think you should kill someone.
Yeah, like, I feel like regardless of what situation you're in, murder is definitely not the answer. But yeah, my answer would be I definitely would rather be Carol Baskins. One, because I feel like even though she's crazy and she's basically doing the same thing that Tiger King is doing.
Yeah.
I think that he is crazy times 10 million.
Yeah, he has like some actual severe personality disorders. Yeah. And she actually does seem like she cares about the cats and he does not at all.
Yeah. So. And I know that like things that she says is like, oh, well, you know, Mike, I don't keep them in cages, but she does. I mean, she does everything that he's doing. She just calls it something different, which I get. But like,
you know what? I was really impressed that she had all those volunteers working for years
for free.
And you know what? I'm kind of like, I kind of respect that.
Well,
as much as I'm like, you got to pay individuals and like you think about the person and everything. But like from a business owner perspective, free labor is great.
Yeah. I mean,
not that I own a business.
No. But and you also like, you have to be a really good recruiter to
it's all cult.
Like you can't there's no way. I say this every time we talk about a cult, we should cover a cult. Cause I love a good cult.
And with all that, welcome to DNA, a True Crime Podcast. I'm Devin the D.
And I'm Asia the A. We also wish both of us were Carol Baskins and not Tiger King if we had a choice.
Survey is in.
Yeah.
I'm Carol the C.
And I'm Carol 2.0.
And welcome to CNC, a True Crime Podcast.
Where we don't kill our husbands.
Not at all.
No.
But going back to what we were saying what I was saying anyways, that sometimes, you know, a situation is not just a black and white, like, murder, cold-blooded situation. Sometimes there are people that are trapped and forced into situations that they feel like they can't get out of. Like, I think Carol Baskin was with her first husband, or her first and second, actually,
yeah,
if you think about it. It fits perfectly in with this week's episode.
Ooh, okay.
So that was a really great... You didn't even know any of that.
I didn't.
And I'm very happy you asked me that question.
Oh, good. Okay.
This week's episode also reminded me a lot thematically of the case that we cover on Dirty John Season 2.
Oh, okay.
And for those of you who don't know, I worked as the writer's assistant on Season 1 and 2 of Dirty John, which is a show based on true crime, cases around... I guess they're both Southern California right now, but we'll see in the future. Who knows what the future holds? But Season 1, we covered the story that the podcast Dirty John covered, and we're doing an anthology series. So Season 2 is a whole new case, a whole new cast, and everything. And while these are true stories, it is a fictionalized, scripted version of it.
Yeah.
And Season 2 covers Betty Broderick and the murder of her ex-husband, Dan Broderick, and his new wife, Linda Colcana Broderick. And everybody has villainized Betty for so long. And this season, the goal was to really, like, get into her mindset and, like, definitely not condone murder. Murder is not condoned. But to understand how... when someone is backed into a corner, they're going to act out. And this case today is like a precursor to Betty Broderick.
Oh, wow.
And it's the story of Ruby McCollum and the murder of Dr. Leroy Adams. If you're interested in Dirty John, it premieres on USA Network on June 2nd. I'm so, so proud of this season. I love working with everybody on it. It's so great. It's going to star Amanda Peet and Christian Slater. And I'm really proud of it, and I'm really proud to work with, like, such a cool team and such a great showrunner.
Yeah.
So I hope you check it out if you're interested.
This is not an ad. We're not getting paid to say that.
I'm not getting paid. I'm just, like, very proud of having been involved in some way.
Exactly. And we both love the showrunner. We actually both worked for her. Actually, that's how we met.
Yeah.
And she's amazing.
Her name is Alexandra Cunningham. Yep. You should check her out.
She's awesome. We love you, Alex. I hope you listen.
Okay, so when I started researching this case, it was so crazy because I actually logged on to newspaper.com, which I want to give a shout out to my cousin, Alice Gamble, who hooked us up with an account at newspapers.com and literally, like, changed the game.
Oh, awesome.
For me. Because this case happened in 1952, and with newspapers.com, this is also not an ad, but I'm just very excited about it. With newspapers.com, I was able to actually see the actual articles and the whole newspaper pages of articles that were printed about this case. It was nuts.
Oh my gosh. So thank you, Alice. I'm so jealous. That was incredible. Can I use it too?
I know. Yeah, of course.
Oh, yay.
So when I first searched for Ruby McCollum on newspapers.com, I was like, it was this Saturday, which is April 25th. And the first hit that came up was from Sunday, April 25th, 1953. Can you believe? So crazy.
That is.
Isn't that? I was like, oh, meant to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
So nuts. Okay. So basically, this is like an historical case dating back to 1953. Ruby McCollum was born Ruby Jackson August 31st, 1909, day after my birthday.
Oh, wow.
So Virgo, hey.
You pick a lot of Virgo.
You know what? A lot of Virgos murder people. Like, there's a list of serial killers, and, like, most of them are Virgos.
That's so funny.
You know what? If you can't get with the program, I'm sorry. You got to get out.
Yeah, that's so hilarious. And Virgos will
take care of it. She was born just outside of Ocala, Florida. And she was the second of seven children. And her parents ran a cattle farm and were, you know, black farmers in Florida, like North Florida, deep south. She was born in 1909. So just like 20 something odd years after slavery ended. So like very fresh. She grew up in Jim Crow era, like deep south situation. However, her parents did fairly well for farmers. Like, obviously, being black, they weren't allowed to do that well. But they were able to take care of everybody, but they still lived very modestly. She lived in, like, a two-bedroom house with seven kids and two parents. So I don't even know who slept where.
Well, when you said she was, like, with seven kids, I was like, damn. But it's 1909. Yeah. Nope.
It's 1909.
No birth controls. Yeah. Like, nope. You know, I get it. All right.
And it's like, yeah. And her father, William Jackson, was a steward at the African Methodist Church. And her mother, Gertrude, was a Sunday school superintendent. So also it was their duty to bring forth children into the world. You know.
All right.
They basically were only, they weren't allowed to dance, play cards, dominoes, or checkers, which were, like, fun, flashy things back then. and they basically could, like, pray and sing hymns and then, like, play, like, Red Rover-type games in the yard. And that's, like, all they were allowed to do. But I still imagine it was, like, a very fun childhood because you just, like, run around on the farm. You have so many brothers and sisters.
Oh, my God, like, yeah. That's my dream. Like, that's what I want an adult right now. I want a farm. I want, like, acres. I want cows. I want pigs. I want horses.
Oh, my God.
And I will play Red Rover with my children for sure.
Absolutely.
My favorite game ever. Yeah.
This is a total sidebar, but in elementary school, there was a girl in my class that had scoliosis, and she had a fiberglass brace on, and everybody always wanted her on her Red Rover team because she would just book it and run and then slam her brace into the people's hands, and it hurt so bad, but that team always won. She was the best.
Wow. Good for her.
I know.
I love that.
Get it.
Do you want to, like, go halvesies on a farm with me?
Yeah, absolutely. Gabe and I actually have been taking, like, quarantine walks and finding, like, empty plots of land and being like, what would we build here?
Oh, I'm totally in.
Yeah.
I'm there.
There's a plot of land in Chatsworth that I'm like, I could afford it right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's, like, not that much money.
Yeah.
Okay, back to Ruby, though.
All right, Ruby.
The lady we're all here for. So, one super fascinating thing about this case too is that Zora Neale Hurston, author of Their Eyes Were Watching God, anthropologist, was actually sent to cover the case, and she wrote a 10-piece installment on Ruby for the Pittsburgh Courier, which I got to read because of newspaper.com. Amazing. Zora Neale Hurston said of the parents' strictness in not allowing them to play cards or checkers, you know, dominoes, all that stuff, that, quote, that would seem to this stern and devout couple too much like harboring the very works of the devil.
Oh,
so
geez,
very serious. They also weren't allowed to, what Zora Neale Hurston said was, they weren't allowed to visit other people, which meant that they couldn't, like, go over to friends' houses. It was very, they wanted everybody to, like, stay together, stay put, stay insular, which, like, you got seven kids, you got to keep track of them.
Yeah,
I get it.
Yeah.
Ruby's brother Clemens said, quote, Mama promised us a whipping if we did that, and we sure got it too. Ruby got her share. When Mama said a thing, she meant it. She was not the kind that had to wait for Papa to come home to get order. She got order right now when she spoke, or we caught it. I was like, okay, I know everything I need to know about Mama.
Yeah. And, like,
and Ruby being the oldest girl, with, like, she is just sucking that in.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah. And I love the fact that, what did he say, that she didn't have to wait for dad to come home to, like, get, oh, woo, that gave me the chills.
I know.
Yeah, mama, get it. Get it, girl.
Yeah, seriously. And according to Clement, Ruby was typically obedient, but when she made up her mind to break the rules, like, she went hard. She had fun. She did what she was going to do. And then she came home and she took her punishment with, like, stoic face. Ah. Like, you know.
Like, she was willing to take the consequences.
I did the crime. I'm going to do the time. And I'm not going to complain about it. Yeah. Yeah.
But I had fun in the process.
Yeah, exactly. And she never tried to defend herself either. She never tried to, like, reason with her parents about, like, why she did what she did. She, like, knew what the price was. And the only time she spoke out was when she was blamed for something that she didn't do. Which those kind of, like, things you'll see, like, coming forward.
Is that foreshadowing?
Her whole life. Yes. Ruby loved school and was a very quick learner. She was very smart. She didn't have a lot of friends, but the ones she did have, she was super close with. At 10 years old, Ruby discovered romance novels. Ooh. And more and more. I know, 10 years old, scandalous. And she spent less and less time outside and more time reading and, like, getting into this romantic headspace. Zora Neale Hurston says that by the time Ruby finished high school, three traits of personality developed. One being that she held her cards close to her chest, never really talked about her thoughts or feelings, which I feel like is a very old eldest sister thing. The second one was that she was frugal. Like, she wasn't super interested in material things. Like, she always looked good and kept, took care of herself. But she took a lot of pride in what she had and, like, really maintained her clothes and her shoes rather than buying new things, and chose instead to save a lot of her money. And the last quality was that she had a very strong maternal instinct. And Ruby was always very pretty, but because she was quiet and she was reserved, she either didn't notice or didn't act on male attention. And when she was 17, she actually had a boy in town propose to her, but she refused him because she was like, "You dumb." She was like, he couldn't give her, like, the amazing mental sparks that she wanted, and just, like,
oh my gosh,
deliver on conversation.
So, oh my gosh, I love her. Good she for was you. Like, yeah, no, bro, you're not on my level, and you're not mentally or like, and that's connected anything. Obviously to your emotions. It's not like you're not, like, stimulating to me.
Yeah,
like, why would
she
I
wants more? Why would she stop for the first guy that, like, blinks at her?
Yeah.
You know?
The first guy willing to get on his knee is probably not the best. So.
Right. Yeah, seriously. At 18, she went and taught grade school for a year, but left after only 1 year. And, like, there was no record. The school won't say anything, and she never said anything about why she left, which I think is, like, so funny, because imagine, like, your first job when you were 18 and, like, I don't know. I would quit things in, like, spectacular fashion and, like, not want to do shit. And I can just imagine being 18-year-old and teaching, like, a bunch in, like, a one-room schoolhouse. Oh, what a nightmare.
Yeah. I worked for my mom when I was. Okay. So, well, there was no. And if I, like, allowed. If I wanted to quit, I wasn't allowed to quit. But I also loved it. Like, I worked with kids and I did her accounting and all that stuff. But, you know.
Yeah,
I definitely was not the best 18-year-old either. I was definitely partying and all that, so I get it.
Well, what is the best 18-year-old, you know? No such thing.
Yeah, you're right.
Because either way, you're like, oh, if you're too, like, focused, you're supposed to be having fun. You're 18. And if you're having too much fun, it's like, you need to think about your future. Yeah. So what are you supposed to do?
There's no happy medium ever, really.
No. Nope. Can't win. You might as well die. Yeah. Just kidding. Don't do that. I'm feeling very, like, morbid and stuck inside right now, so this is great.
Yeah. I've got my wine, so I'm good.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about it all you want.
My drizzly order going.
Hashtag not an ad.
Not an ad. Yeah, we have a lot of no ads today.
Yeah.
I'm staying on track really great. This is good.
Yeah. Deep breath.
So after the year at the school, she came home, Well, she still lived at home, but she was like, done, hate it. She tried doing like the traditional school teacher thing, like not a lot of opportunities for smart young women in that time. So she did what they would do, which was teach school, mm-hmm. wasn't into it. And with all her romance novels that she loved, Zora Neale Hurston says that she began to sense a lack. There was no one around whom she could drape her intense feelings, her great capacity for love. Hmm. And I was like, oh, that's such like, I mean, honestly, why am I surprised that Zora Neale Hurston has such a way with words? Mm-hmm. But I love that, like, no one around on which she could drape her feelings. Mm-hmm. It's like, it is kind of passive because it doesn't really matter who it is. But also, maybe that's what Ruby felt. She was used to black men asking her out, and even, quote, white men winked their eyes at her and followed her, or secretly nodded at her to please follow them. What? Which I was like, oh, God, follow them into, like, an alley? Yikes. That was, like, the first taste of, like, what's to come in this, where it's like, what kind of world was this at that time? Mm-hmm. But Hurston goes on to say, yes, numerous men had gazed on her with open desire, but so far their looks had raised no mingling blood call in her. So she was just like a beautiful girl getting lots of attention, not really into anything. Mm-hmm. But then Ruby met Sam McCullen, and 2 years later in 1931, they were married.
Okay.
Sam was charming. He was a smooth talker. He was ambitious. He sort of had a finger in a lot of pots and would be doing a lot of work. He came from another wealthy farming family, like a couple towns over, and they hit it off, but she kind of questioned if he could give her the romance that she wanted. But then she, after 2 years, she was just like, this is it. Yeah. So they got married.
Okay.
They did struggle a little bit in the beginning because Sam's family felt like Ruby was domineering and possessive, because Ruby didn't like that Sam often took jobs that took him away from home for weeks at a time.
Hmm.
So I'm kind of like,
yeah, I get that.
Like, yes and no. I could see both sides to mm-hmm. that. Ruby also found out that Sam's brother ran an illegal gambling ring.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that Sam kind of, like, was involved in that. Okay. So, I'm assuming that maybe she, like, objected to that mm-hmm. a bit. And then, you know, the brother was like,
yeah,
what are you getting involved in this for?
Is there, like, a sense of, like, trust issues here with him, you think, with on her end? Is, like, she's like, I don't like that he's away.
Yeah, I think it was maybe trust, but I think it too, she had an idea of what marriage would be like for her, and mm-hmm. that wasn't really it. And her first time living away from her home and her family, it's a big adjustment.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that played into it. Mm-hmm. And not getting along with his family also wasn't great.
Yeah.
But eventually Ruby did start going with him, and they actually moved to New York for a while. And while Sam was working in construction and, you know, doing his things, Ruby actually managed their finances in their home. So Sam would come home and, like, give her his paycheck, and Ruby would, like, just take care of business because she was a boss.
Yeah.
In New York, Sam got into the gambling scene, but generally he was successful. So they actually made a really nice living from the gambling. So Ruby got on board.
Okay.
In 1932 in New York, Ruby had their first child, a boy, Sam Jr. And then I couldn't pinpoint exactly when, but while they were still in New York, they had a daughter there named Kay.
Okay.
The couple eventually moved to Live Oak, Florida, and moved into a luxurious 9-room house that Sam actually won in a gambling bet.
Wow.
Right, because they, like, came into town, Ruby saw the house, and she's like, oh my God, this is the house of my dreams. Zora Neale Hurston says that Ruby would have a recurring dream about, like, owning this, like, particular house, and that in real life, when Ruby saw the house, she's like, that's the house in my dream.
Mm-hmm.
Which, who knows if that really happened or not, but poetic.
Yeah. That reminds me of, have you seen the movie Enough with J-Lo?
No.
Okay. Well, there's a movie called Enough starring J-Lo, and I can't remember any of the other actors' names, but, like, she meets this guy, and he does pretty much that, where he, like, she looks at the house, and she's like, I want that house. And he basically goes up and says, like, hey, so we love your house, and we're willing to give you X amount of money. And the guy's like, well, it's not for sale. And he's like, yeah, it is. And, like, forces this guy, like, threatens him and makes him move out of this house. But he ends up being an abuser, and then she kicks his ass and kills him at the end, so.
Oh, well, that's good. So the guy that owned the house originally was the guy in town that ran, like, the Bolita rings, which, have you heard of Bolita?
No.
It's, like, a game, but it's kind of like bingo or, like, a lottery where they have, like, the ping pong balls with the numbers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And basically you make, like, small bets on, like, what number is going to be drawn.
Okay.
And then, like, that's the whole game. Mm-hmm. But it's very easily rigged. So Sam won a game of Bolita, and, like, the guy was like, well, I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. Have my house and also the Bolita ring. So.
Wow. So did Sam rig it?
There's not, like, confirmation or anything, but, like, my guess is yes.
Yeah, okay.
So they moved in, they had the two kids, and they just, like, spent years amassing their wealth. Sam worked in insurance. They owned a funeral parlor.
Damn, he's had a lot of jobs.
I know. He just is, like, a very enterprising business guy. Mm-hmm. And he, but, like, they've got their main source of income from the Bolita halls, from selling liquor and owning juke joints, which I was like, ooh, I'd love to go cut a rug at a juke joint.
Yeah. Let's do that once we're out of quarantine.
I know, right? All that stuff, not the funeral parlors, but the gambling halls, liquor, and the juke joints were all illegal, but he just paid off authorities, so there was never any threat or, like, anything. It was, like, you know,
yeah,
technically illegal, but, like, as long as you paid your fine
or
whatever, it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
But because of all these businesses, this actually made them the richest couple in town.
Wow.
So they were, like, big ballin' badasses. And Ruby was still all in charge of all of the finances. So mm-hmm. she was, like, Sam was out there making money, making deals, all this stuff. But Ruby was the one that really made their money work for them.
Okay.
There was a point where every year she drove a new car in, like, the 30s and 40s.
Wow.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she got a bad reputation about being stingy because she would, like, nickel and dime people and didn't want to, like, give up the money. She wanted to, like, hoard it away because it turned out she was saving it for her kids. She would put it all in, like, a fund for her kids, but which also meant that she would, like, get really, like, down to
And I don't penny. I hate that word, like, when you're stingy, like, so that you, basically she just didn't want to pay more than something was worth because she knew that that money was better used for saving and for her kids and, like, her lifestyle.
Yes and no, because I think that my understanding from, like, the articles that I was reading that were written in the time, so there's a little bit of, like, you know, who knows how they aged or what they really mean, but was that she would agree to a price and then after the work was done say, I'm not paying that.
Ah, okay.
So, and, you know, I don't know how often or whatever, but, like, that was the reputation that she got, and reputations aren't always true, you know. So they're, like, flying high. Life is good. Mm-hmm. Ruby loves Sam. But then Ruby finds out that Sam is having affairs.
Ooh.
And not just, like, a affair. Right. He was having, like, shit tons of affairs. But they would be, like, hookups or, like, flings.
Oh, okay.
And they would be mostly with the young women that would come in from the small towns around to, like, work for the summer. And, like, I didn't get this for sure, but my impression was, like, young women meaning, like, maybe 16.
Ooh!
So, not great. Sam's not really aging well in this story. And just, like, he's, like, you know, money, cars, all women, all this stuff. and just like kind of like bawling out and being an asshole about it,
mm-hmm.
and making it no secret. Everybody in town knew.
Yeah.
So obviously Ruby was so hurt, mm-hmm. and she went to Sam and was like, "You need to stop. Money has gone to your head. Like, we are married. We're in a marriage. Like, that means something to me. You need to stop this. I love you." And he basically was like, "I got you the house you wanted. You have money. You can buy whatever you want. Why are you trying to ruin this?" And basically was like, "No, goodbye." And then so she was like stuck because it was like all that stuff is true. Marriage does mean something to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she did love him, and she was just trying to like survive. And every time he left the house, it was like off to see another girl, and she's like left there taking care of the kids, feeling humiliated, and just like years and years and years of that. She tells, there's one story that she was like, this was it for me, where Sam had a bunch of friends over and was having a big party, which Ruby was not comfortable with. She didn't grow up having people over. She didn't grow up socializing that way. And she didn't like really like having people in her house,
mm-hmm.
which I totally identify with.
Yes, absolutely.
And Sam is just like pouring drinks, everything. Everyone's getting so fucking wasted, and people are throwing up everywhere, getting in fights, passing out. And Ruby like pulls Sam aside and starts yelling at him and is like, "Get these fucking people out of my house.
Yeah,
this is not okay. You didn't ask me. None of this is okay." And basically, Sam, like, took off his belt and beat her. And then Ruby was like, "Okay."
Oh, my gosh. This is so...
Yeah. And so, as he's doing stuff like that, as he's going about town and having an affairs, he, at the same time, was bragging about how he had, like, the perfect wife back at home. How he would, like, go out and like sleep with some little bimbo and come home and Ruby would have the house clean and dinner prepped for him. And he would like say that to people. And it's a small town. There's like 4,000 mm-hmm. people. Like, people know everybody. Yeah. And Ruby is just in her hell. Like, the person that wanted romance and love and everything
mm-hmm.
was just like lost it all because of money.
Yeah.
But then Ruby got pregnant with their third child. Ugh. So Ruby was like, "Oh, well, this could be the thing that could bring us back together. Like, we have so many problems, and like maybe a baby will fix things, and like it'll be so excited." And Sam was really excited to have another baby, but he just celebrated with everybody else and not Ruby, and just kept the whole thing up. Wow. And then, yeah, just like that, years and years and years of neglect and like psychological abuse like that and everything, it just like Ruby was totally broken down.
Mm-hmm.
And so then one night, as Ruby's pregnant, Sam comes home and he's like, "Oh, Ruby, I made a new white friend. You gotta come meet him. He's in the living room." And they made a big deal about but it was a big deal that Sam, who is a big, you know, black businessman in town, made a white friend who was also a big businessman in town. Okay. So, and like that a white man is like in their home and like meeting on equal terms with Sam. It's exciting. It's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So Sam brings Ruby in and introduces him to Dr. C. Leroy Adams, who had just moved to Live Oak.
Okay.
And Sam was doubly excited because he was a big doctor, he was well-connected, and he was accepting black patients, which the other white doctors in Live Oak didn't do.
Okay.
And Ruby was pregnant, and Sam was like, "He's your doctor now." And Ruby was like, "Oh, I have a doctor. I go to Dr. Dillard, I think is his name." and Sam was like, "Nope, he's your doctor now." So, like, Ruby had, like, no choice about, like, who's going to be, like, examining her and all that stuff. And so when Ruby, like, went and met him.
So, basically, what you're saying is that she had no control over her pregnancy or her body at all?
Correct.
Wow, so things haven't changed much.
No. Nope. So she went in and she, like, introduced him. And she's met with this, like, 6'4 guy who's, like, 240 pounds, like a big guy, but he's like charming and boisterous and everything, and he's like immediately giving her that look that she knows.
Oh,
and just
no.
is like, and Sam's like right there. Dr. Adams was just like overtly flirting with Ruby, and she just got really uncomfortable, so she left, and she like left Sam and Dr. Adams, but like basically was like, this guy is gonna be like a creepazoid to me, and he has to be my doctor, but like I'm kind of stuck in this situation because he's friends with my husband, but like maybe he's harmless, maybe it's just like maybe he's just a flirt and just like, you know, likes to like I fuck people or whatever, I don't know. So she was kind of like,
but that's a very gross thing to think of while you're basically spread eagle in front of a doctor.
Well, that wasn't that time. That was just when she met him the first time. This was not like a doctor examination. This was literally they're in the living room of her house.
Okay.
And he was all like, right. Hey, pretty lady or whatever.
Ugh. Okay.
But yeah, so basically he made her feel uncomfortable, but she was like kind of stuck. So she just like went along with her pregnancy. She had the baby. She had a baby girl named Sonia, and Dr. Adams delivered the baby. Everything was fine. The birth went great. The baby was great, but Ruby was recovering really slowly. And she had like some medicine that she was taking, but she said it would like make her feel really ill afterwards and like not actually help. And she would have these recurring thoughts and just be so afraid that she would die and leave her children motherless with nobody to care for them. And she just kept thinking that. And then she realized that in that scenario that she was like focusing on, that Sam wasn't even in the picture. So she was like, oh, I do not love him anymore. Like, that is totally dead. Which gave her an amount of freedom, because she was like, it still hurt her, his actions and everything, but like when you're not forlorn anymore, it is a bit of freedom.
Yeah. And it's definitely easier to separate yourself from the relationship and the situation, because she did say at one point, like, I love you, just I want you to stop doing these things. And he's like, nah, I'm not gonna do that.
Yeah.
And she was kind of willing to do anything. And even this baby, she was hopeful that that would change the dynamic of their relationship, which I guess
it did, because she was like,
it changed the way she
changed
felt
the way
because
on her end, which wasn't
on her
she
end,
anticipated.
Yeah. Right. And which ultimately would be the thing that she needed to get through it, you know.
But she was never going to go file for divorce. She was never going to leave him. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not something that she was going to do. So, but she could like take their like arrangement or whatever you want to call it a little bit more. But Ruby was dealing with postpartum depression, you know, at that time you don't know what it is. This is in the 40s at this point. But she asked Dr. Adams to come make a house call, and she was just like at her lowest, feeling horrible about herself, feeling so like just years of rejection, all the hormones, everything, worried about herself and her baby. And she's telling him all this and telling him her physical symptoms, telling him her mental state. And he listened, and he like didn't really say anything for a while. And then he finally said, I can get you well if you will do as I tell you. And like, that's when that started. So that night they hooked up, shall we say.
No.
And Ruby said that she was so relieved because she was gonna feel better. So she was like, whatever. And also at that point she had been so beaten down physically and emotionally by Sam and his actions, that any attention felt like a positive thing to her.
Yeah.
And when you're in that headspace, I want to be very clear about what's going on here. Because when you're in that headspace about where somebody has abused you, your reality changes. And your ability to deduce and like make fair and rational choices is diminished because everything you know to be true is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a power dynamic here. This woman is seeking help from her healthcare professional, and he is using the power in that situation to get his way sexually with her. So mm-hmm. no matter how badly she wanted it, or he thought she wanted it, or she thought she wanted it, or didn't want it because she wanted to feel better. She didn't want a sexual relationship with him. So she didn't yeah. really want it. That's an abuse of power, and that's mm-hmm. not okay. So yeah. that happened that first night. She immediately felt guilty, but Dr. Adams started prescribing her like all these pills to take, and
that she probably didn't need.
Well, yeah, they did help, though. She said she started feeling better, but she also immediately felt guilty. But then one night she got an anonymous phone call from, it was a woman, she could tell, but she didn't know the voice. And they said, like, you might have Sam's money, but you'll never have Sam's heart. And she's like, after that, she felt much less guilty. Which is, like, funny, but also not
so funny. Because I just find it comical that these women that he's hooking up with actually think he has a heart.
I know. And I'm like, so okay, it's just like 15-year-old, like, what do you think you're going to be the next Mrs. McCollum? Like, please.
Yeah, because he's choosing. Yeah, like, come on now.
Yeah.
God.
Tale as old as time. But Dr. Adams continued his meetings with Ruby, continued making these house calls, would call her into the office, and what she, like, originally she had that feeling of like, oh, this is flattering, like, it's nice to feel wanted again, very quickly just turned sour, and like she realized that she had gone from one controlling, abusive guy to mm-hmm. another, but there was no way to get away from either of them. And with all the medicine, she was becoming hooked on it. So she needed Ugh. Dr. Adams to keep prescribing her and keep giving her this medication. And he basically like drugged her into being a sex slave.
And oh my God.
Just like, I can't, there's not a lot of detail about like the actual stuff that went on because, mm-hmm. you know, there's a different level of propriety back then and everything. But I just can't. It went on for years. And then Ruby found out she was pregnant.
No. Oh, my God. I thought that. Like, when yeah. you started, I was like, I bet you she's going to get pregnant.
Yep.
And then have to explain that somehow.
Well, she told Sam. And all he did was, like, move into another bedroom. He wasn't like, Dr. Adams, stop, nothing. He was like, great, you have your life and I'll have my life. And I was like, you wow. fucker. Like, just,
yeah.
But eventually Ruby gave birth to another baby girl and they named her Loretta. Dr. Adams delivered the baby. And reportedly when Loretta was born, Dr. Adams pulled his friend Sam, because they were still friends. He pulled Sam aside and said, I love all my children, white and inwards. This is my baby. You take care of it and see it gets proper care. How fucked up is that on every level? Every way you think about it,
I'm having worse. A very not, like, my reaction is to laugh is not because it's funny.
It's just unbelievable. It's
so unbelievably.
Like, let's look at this language, right? So first of all, N-word. Great. We get it. I love all my children. So he has other kids.
Yeah, and probably with women who were forced to do it.
Yes. And probably this is not his first black mixed kid. Mm-hmm. He says, this is my baby. So, like, dominion over Sam already. You take care of it. and see it gets proper care. I'm sorry, do you really love your child then? Because you're not taking care of her. You know it's a girl. You delivered her. You're saying it. You're objectifying her. Where is Ruby? He goes to talk to Sam. Oh, this just made me so angry.
Oh my God.
So angry.
It's so infuriating, to be honest. It's just like...
And
how fucking dare you?
I know.
How dare you?
Just like,
it's like it just makes me think of those stories.
Walking in.
This well, is my land. It's like the stories of the men who rape women, and then when the woman gets pregnant, then they want to be like, well, this is my child too, so I should have rights to see my child. And it's like, no, but that wasn't your objective. Your objective was to assault her and hurt her. Not to impregnate her, and this is just the thing that you want to. It's almost like a trophy. Like
it's murderers. Totally
murderers keep trophies, and I feel like men who rape women and then end up fathering their children just use the child as a trophy, and it's
fucking a literal
disgusting.
Like manifestation of their power, and they're like not viewed as real people, you know. And this has been going on since the dawn of time.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know,
and the fact that the country is like our country, the world is like just waking up to this is infuriating within itself.
I know.
It's disgusting.
So after Loretta's birth, Sam was never the same. He lost like his joie de vivre and his spirit and like didn't stop like fucking about, but it like everybody knew that like Ruby having someone else's kid just broke him. And I was like, oh, well,
maybe you
treated her better and not forced her into a rapist's arms.
Yeah.
And
like you did it because you were getting your way in the moment. And then now all of a sudden that you're not getting your way. Now you're depressed. Go fuck yourself. Oh, God.
And
I hate
him. Course, Sam publicly claimed Loretta as his own, and her name was Loretta McCollum, because Adams isn't gonna like be like, oh yes, that one's mine.
And was child support a thing then?
No,
you think?
Definitely not.
So like, of course he could just do it and get away with it, and that was it.
Yeah. But like, obviously Loretta is mixed, and Ruby was very dark skinned, and she would be like walking around with a light skinned baby. So people started talking, but Sam and Ruby never said a word about it. In 1952, Dr. Adams was elected to state senate. So he just kept amassing power, amassing, you know, all this stuff. His buddy, Dr. Dillard Workman, who this was Ruby's previous physician, who she left to go to Dr. Adams, campaigned for him and said that he was on track to be the next governor of Florida.
Wow.
And then Ruby got pregnant again.
What?
Yeah, because this was still going on.
She was still seeing him?
Yeah, I
like,
mean, like,
as her,
not
as her
she
physician?
Had a choice. No, it got to the point where she was hooked on these drugs. He is technically her physician, but basically he's like, if you don't come over here, I'm going to kill you. So she would have to go to his office. He started getting involved in Sam's business too. So he was just always around. He just like inserted himself literally and figuratively into their lives and did not go. So she got pregnant again.
I thought that because Sam was starting to feel a way about this whole situation that he would have, like,
no,
at least...
Adams never actually saw Sam as an equal. Like, it was just a stepping stone. And so Sam's feelings never mattered. You know? And not that Sam was, like, super conscious of anyone else's feelings, but, like, nobody deserved anything. But when Ruby got pregnant again and... Dr. Adams found out because he's doing the examination, so she can't even hide it from him. He insisted that Ruby move out to his farm where his white wife lived with his white children, and Ruby could leave her black children and bring Loretta and the new baby and move out to the farm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What? And when I say insisted, It literally was like, there is no choice here. This is like, what you have going to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he wants her to leave her children with Sam,
Right.
And come out to, is he trying to like form some polygamist like?
Well, think about like the slave masters, right? Where you had up in the house, you had your like white wife and the house slaves that were probably their children or their cousins or brothers and sisters. And you could take your pick of the field slaves and you just had like a hot chick on the side that like your wife couldn't say anything about because technically they're your property. So it wasn't technically cheating and it wasn't technically infidelity. It's that mentality. There's a word for it. It's actually called paramour rights. In this time, it was called paramour rights. And they actually, it was like a free pass for white men to basically take black women as lovers and rape them or whatever, have children with them, not owe anything to them, not have to take care of any of their kids. And they would not be held accountable for infidelity, anything like that. And it didn't count, basically. And it was called paramour rights, and it was like an actual legal thing.
And I don't really have any words.
I'm sure all the white wives got upset about it. But they, like, according to this legal thing, they didn't have a right to be upset about it. So everybody is in a terrible situation as these men are just fucking around and abusing everybody.
Wow.
I'm so upset. On August 3rd, 1953, Ruby loaded her two young daughters, Sonia and Loretta, into her car and drove to Dr. Adams' office. She went inside where everybody knew her because she was a patient and also knew that Dr. Adams was whatevering her. And Ruby came under the pretense of discussing a medical bill and She had left the kids in the car, so she came in to be like, what is this bill? But something in that conversation in Dr. Adams' office, like, set him off, and he hit her and started beating her. And so Ruby shot him 4 times.
What?
Yes. And then fled.
Wait, but why did she have a gun?
I think she was ready. I think she was just over it. He was forcing her to move to the farm, and I think this was the time where...
And to leave her children behind.
I think whatever happened in the conversation that we don't know what happened, I think she said, I'm not going.
Yeah. And then he lost his shit. And then she killed him.
And she fled.
Well, I guess I don't know. Did he die?
He did die.
He did die. Okay.
And she fled, but she knew she was leaving a busy doctor's office for gunshots. Like, she knew it was coming. She gets home with her kids, throws the gun into a hedge outside of her house, and then, like, sets her kids up for playtime. And then a few hours later, when the police came to arrest Ruby, she said, oh, I can't go now. There's no one here to watch the children. Which is just...
God.
So, yeah.
Oh, no.
So, basically, Ruby was arrested. Sam came and picked up the kids and went to another town in Florida to, like, protect them because a black woman just murdered a prominent white doctor in town. And... Mm-hmm. Nobody's safe. So he goes, and I think he went to his parents' house. And the day after the arrest, Sam dies of a heart attack. Yeah. So.
Oh, no.
Ruby's in jail. Sam is dead. Dr. Adams is dead.
Yeah.
I don't even know.
What? Oh, my God. That's insane.
I know. So, I mean, it just, like, shows how deeply ingrained in every single one of their lives this abuse went.
Yeah. You know? Oh, God.
Yeah. So Ruby was in jail.
And now that Sam's dead, she really doesn't have any proof that any of this really happened.
Well, yeah, it's all her word, which
word against,
yeah, like, just wait till we get to the trial. Oh my god.
Oh god. Yeah. Because like him being, he like, I'm sure
he could have testified.
I'm not sure. He could have testified on her behalf and been like, listen, this is just something we ignored for this long, yeah, because it was happening and he was a white prominent guy, blah blah blah. But now he's dead.
He's dead.
So she has nothing,
and she never talked about it with anybody, so nobody knows. But Ruby is in jail, and I don't know what happened. If it was stress, if she was beaten, I don't know what happened, but she miscarried in jail.
Oh.
And all she ever said about it was that someone asked her, like, oh, are you still pregnant? And she said, no, but the state knows all about that. And then she never said anything again.
Oh,
I don't,
my gosh.
Maybe she even self-induced it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's... Ugh. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know.
She says,
I don't want to think about it.
I know. She says of that day, I was between two guns that morning, the gun of my husband and the gun of Dr. Adams.
Wow.
And then I'm like, it's so tragic, but then also a part of me is like, yes, girl, so you take that gun and you shoot them both.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't do that. Don't murder.
Mm-mm.
We're not condoning murder.
No,
this is
no.
bad.
But
I can
definitely understand.
Trapped.
Yeah, like I can understand acting out. Like I act out on just like regular like stress
like
and emotions.
Gabe tells me to like clean up after myself.
Yeah,
I'm like
think,
don't
like
tell
little
me what
things.
To do.
Yeah, or like the. Oh my gosh, the thing that sets me off is when somebody is just like, calm down.
Oh yeah,
don't. Tell me, you know, like I lose my shit if that
yeah.
happens. Like I absolutely understand somebody like doing something like this when you're pushed to that
yeah.
point.
Like being,
you know, men or women,
raped,
like, it, but
yeah, but being,
you know,
being
but
constantly
is,
raped,
oh,
being
wow.
forced to bear children and then raise mm-hmm. the children and then leave your original children. Like
yeah.
you, it's madness. And something
wow.
had to change, and so she took matters into her own hands.
Yeah.
And, like, honestly, I'm like, murder is not the answer, but I don't know what else she could have done.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
Really. So, at the trial, like I said before, Zora Neale Hurston came to report on it for the Pittsburgh Courier, which was actually the first publication to cover the trial outside of Florida. And... The Pittsburgh Courier was a weekly African-American newspaper that ran from 1907 to 1966. And then it was bought and rebranded, so it continued to run.
Mm-hmm.
So and that was the newspaper that I got to see, like, the page layouts of. So uh-huh. cool. The ads and everything. I'll send it to you. It was just...
Okay.
That was such a cool experience. So, again, thank you, Alice, for allowing that to happen. And Zora Neale Hurston wrote a 10-piece series on Ruby's life, which focused more on her upbringing and the situation that led to the murder than the actual trial, which was, I don't know if I've really, like, seen something like that before. Like, in 1953, I mean, I don't want to say that we're, you know, Zora Neale Hurston or anything, but,
mm-hmm.
like, our MO in this podcast is to, like, shed light on the victims in this situation, and Ruby was absolutely a victim, and
yeah.
Zora Neale Hurston gave her humanity by talking
mm-hmm.
about her situation, talking about the complexities. Like, Zora Neale Hurston was an anthropologist, so she had all this wealth of knowledge to apply to this world that Ruby was living in, that now to you and me seems so insane, but really was just 60 years ago. Like,
yeah,
that's too close. And the fact that, like, this was allowed to happen at all ever is insane.
Yeah.
And Zora Neale Hurston, her coverage was the stuff that really got this into the mainstream media. And it was one of the most widely covered cases in the nation. Ruby's lawyer was a man named Frank Cannon. The prosecutor was named Keith Black. And the judge was Judge Hal W. Adams, who had no relation to Dr. Adams, but he was a pallbearer at Dr. Adams' funeral. So they were friends.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, okay, let me say that again, because I'm just going to underline it. The judge in Ruby's murder trial was friends with the murder victim. Are you kidding me? Like, okay, so basically there's no point in doing anything, right?
Yeah.
And
at this point, it's like she's kind of like, it's literally like she's shit out of luck regardless. Yeah,
she's like set up. They already know what they want to do. They're done. So also, the jury was all white, which, because at the time, Black people were not considered eligible for jury selection because of, like, voting laws and all that kind of stuff. So, all white jury. And some of them were Dr. Adams' patients.
So, just... this whole idea of having a fair trial based on jury selection... And, like, weeding certain jurors out because of their connection to the case or connected to the defendant or the plaintiff or whatever the case is did not happen here, is what you're saying.
Correct.
Okay.
Honestly, it was a miracle they didn't just lynch her, you know?
Oh, God.
Ugh. Like, that's terrible to say, but it's true.
Yeah.
Judge Hal Adams put a gag order on Ruby, so she was forbidden from giving any interviews, but everybody else could get interviews, and Dr. Adams' wife, like, went on a whole spree giving all these interviews about, like, how terrible Ruby was, all that stuff, which, like, I'm not saying that Ruby was terrible, but, like, I understand why, in her mind, she is gonna go slander her husband's mistress, like, whatever the truth of it is. I'm not condoning that either, but
no,
she's,
and it's like, if she even had a smidgen of the capacity to understand what was happening to Ruby, that obviously this was not of her own, like, she didn't do this to her, like, victims don't do this shit to themselves,
right?
Like,
exactly.
Why in any world would you consider bashing her or making this situation any worse?
Right.
But she had, she didn't have the capacity to even get that at all. So,
Judge Hal Adams also forbade Ruby from speaking about the nature of her relationship with Dr. Adams in trial. So, Ruby was allowed to testify that they had a sexual relationship and that she got pregnant twice, but anytime her lawyer asked to, like, her to elaborate further, go, what does that mean? Were you willing? Any of that, the other lawyer who, the prosecution. The prosecution objected, and the judge sustained it. So,
wow.
Ruby's lawyer, Frank Cannon, tried 38 times to get to be able to say that Ruby was being raped, and 38 times it was struck down.
Oh my God.
And this is where, like, the paramour rights came in, because they were like, it doesn't matter if you were willing or not, like, you're a Black woman, it doesn't matter with you, like, he wanted it, that's all that matters. And that's the thing that they, like, kept going back on, is, like, the nature of your relationship doesn't matter because, like, you are less than, so therefore you are not able to be raped. It's like how we were saying, like, if an animal is murdered, is it murder? No. It's like this. If a non-human person is raped, is it rape? No. That's what they think, because they think that Black people are non-human people.
I feel sick.
On top of that, Ruby was only allowed to testify about the events of the day of the murder. So all she could say was what she did that day.
Wow.
Basically, like, there's no fucking point. She was never going to deny it. We're going back to when she would get in trouble with her parents. She never denied anything she didn't do, right? She took her punishment. And she's doing that here. But also not allowed to give any sort of explanation or anything.
Yeah. Like, any context to the situation that led her to that decision.
Right. So...
And I don't, like... Are they saying that it was premeditated because she had the gun on her when she went there?
I'm going to get into the defense in 1 second. Okay. But Ruby... So, because she was allowed to talk about the events of the day, Ruby testified that Adams hit her and that they fought. And after she said that, the judge silenced her in court regarding additional testimony that would have established mitigating circumstances. So she couldn't even say that. All she could say is, I drove my car with my kids in it, I shot him, and then they went home. That was all she was allowed to say.
But then I thought they said that she could tell them what happened that day.
Because she did tell him, and then it made Dr. Adams look bad because he hit her. And so then she was not allowed to say that anymore.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So.
Oh my God.
Yes. So the prosecution, this is their theory. They claimed that she killed him over a $116 medical bill. Because she had that reputation of being stingy and frugal.
Oh, okay.
Yep. And.
Yeah.
3 white witnesses testified to this. So people at the doctor's office.
Oh, but the white people are allowed to tell something outside of.
Of course.
Oh.
Of course.
Okay.
Which Ruby did admit that she, like, the reason that she went there originally was to, like, be like, oh, I got this bill, to, like, have an opening mm-hmm. in the conversation, but that wasn't the point of the conversation. So.
Yeah, the point of the conversation was, I don't want to fucking move to your farm, you narcissistic
right.
asshole.
Right.
This is my child. This is, like, I'm not going to abandon my children.
Yeah. But she wasn't allowed to say any of that. I know. No, this is absolutely infuriating. Eventually, Ruby was sentenced to death by the electric chair.
Oh, my God.
Because what else can we expect? But Ruby's lawyer, Frank Cannon, Angel, appealed Ruby's case, and the conviction and death sentence were actually overturned on a technicality in July 1954.
Okay.
And that technicality was that Judge Hal Adams failed to be present at the jury's inspection of the scene of the crime. Which I didn't know that was the thing. But I thought that was, like, an interesting little tidbit. And also, like, where do you have to be?
Yeah. Like, why? I mean, I'm glad that it was overturned of because of this reason. But I'm kind of like...
But it just shows how, like, he was not even... Like, fair trial is such bullshit. But as we know from listening to last week's episode with Curtis Flowers, if your conviction is overturned, you stand to be tried again. So Ruby is still in jail, and there was a little bit of time between her trials, and in that time, it just, like, blew up in the media, and so many people had stuff to say about it. And it was, like, honestly a precursor to what we do, like, precursor to the true crime podcast. It was, like, the first really widely discussed and, like, theorized situation. And from newspapers.com, thank you, Alice, I actually found a page in the Pittsburgh Courier that every week they published people's letters that they would send in and published their thoughts about Ruby in a column called Ruby, Good or Bad. and I want to read I want to read all of them, but I'll read all of them and then maybe you can pick which ones you think are best, or leave them all because they're like,
let's just leave them all.
It's fascinating. Okay,
God, just do them all.
The first one, Irene Corpening from Lenoir, North Carolina, says, I am truly sorry for Ruby. I know she has done a great wrong. So let's just let Ruby and God work that out and let you and I not try to take God's place. Which I was like, oh, that's nice.
Okay.
Mary Emma Jenkins from Henderson, Texas, says, it is altogether fitting and proper that we should all stick together and try to be for Ruby. I have not went with a white man, and I have no desire to go with one, but I still have sympathy for Ruby because she is a woman of our race. Which I was like, okay, solidarity. Little bit of judgment. I don't need to know your sexual history, Mary Emma, but okay.
Yeah.
Mrs. DGM from Arlington, Alabama, says, I do not believe in the different races of people mixing sexually, but if justice were done, there would be a lot of Rubies and Johns. I think John just means Dr. Adams. Just only 3 miles from my home, the law went into a colored woman's house. She had to be confined to a wheelchair a year or more. They just walked up and beat her head to the fat just because they could. So why do we judge? Why do we judges want to electrocute Ruby?
Huh. So she mean Johns as like...
I think that means just like boys you sleep with.
Okay. Is that the reason why we call like...
Maybe. I'm not really sure.
People who hire sex workers, yeah. Johns?
I'm not... some of the grammar in that one was also a little bit odd.
Yeah.
But interesting sort of like immediately... I don't believe in people of races mixing sexually. So like, Asia, you and me are fucked.
Oh, yeah.
But then she's like, actually, like...
We would not survive in that time.
Hello, sure. No, not at all.
They'd be like, first of all, black girl, me, dating a white guy, and you about to marry a black guy. It would be, like, we would be in this column.
Oh,
like,
for sure. This
would be they would do one without us.
Oh, my God. That's why we need our farm to get away from this.
Yeah.
Mrs. G. Smith from San Antonio, Texas says, Ruby didn't do anything wrong by going with Dr. Adams. He was only a man like anyone else, and she certainly isn't the only woman in the South that fell for a white man. The white man treats the Negro woman better. Don't ever pass a law for mixed marriages. Our goose would be cooked, and the South would be ruined.
Whoa.
Whoa. Hello.
She went deep. Which is so funny because I actually remember, I can say this because my mom doesn't listen to our podcast because it's too much for her, but she at one point when I told her that I was dating, you know, a white guy, she had said to me something along the lines, I don't remember verbatim, but like, you know, that white men treat black women like who they are attracted to like queens,
like the goddesses, like, they are.
Exactly. And it was just so funny because like that's what she had, and I thought it was going to be more of like, are you sure, you know, like, are you sure you want to do this? But it was more of like, good for you, because you know what, he's going to treat you like a queen. The queen that you are. It was kind of amazing. But
that's also an interesting, like, it's almost a double standard, because I feel like if like I've okay, listen, I don't know what I'm talking about right now. Let's just say I am a white lady with white parents. I've never even thought or like discussed like interracial relationships growing up or like what that means. And I totally understand why some black people believe that people should marry, and black people in specific,
within their race,
marry within their race and preserve the blackness. And I totally respect that.
Yeah.
I do see sometimes that if a black woman, of a black woman is dating a white man, it's a little like, oh, good for you, great, like a positive reaction, which is, I think, a nice thing. And sometimes if a black man is dating a white woman, then there's a little bit of a negative reaction because
And he is ridiculed and put on. He's judged more because he's not finding the women of his own race suitable to marry or be with.
Right. Which like is a very complicated situation, and it's not like we're very much boiling it down and everything. Mm-hmm. But it goes to that, like, you know, rejection of self, and that, you know, black women are the most disenfranchised group of people in this country, and the history of like beauty standards and all of that sort of thing. So, but it's an interesting sort of like, you know, take on it, where like I don't think like a black woman's blackness is questioned if her partner is not black, but sometimes a black man's blackness is questioned.
Absolutely. So, yeah, but you know, the way that, I mean, I have seen even within myself, like I have been praised more than I have been anything else being in a relationship with a white man. Like, we were in Louisiana, which is like, that's a real, I'm not even gonna say it, but we were in Louisiana, he was shooting a movie, and I would fly out there like every other weekend while he was shooting, And we went to a restaurant and we were walking down the street, just like holding hands, like after dinner to go back to our hotel. And this woman from across the street, a black woman, screamed at us and she was like, "Yeah, I like that swirl." And I literally was like, "Oh my God, did she really just scream that at us from across the street?" And he had no idea. Like, he was kind of like, "What does that even mean?" Because he's so oblivious to, like,
what that actually means. You're not taught any of that stuff.
Yeah. So he was like, what does she mean? Like, I don't understand even what's happening. And I had to, like, explain it to him. And he was like, oh. Like, it doesn't dawn on him, because a lot of us, when we deal with relationships, the people who, I don't want to say normal, because normal is such a bad word in my book, but like, love or relationships don't have to be defined by your race. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, the integrity and the, like, the best part of your relationship will never be about your race. Right. And I think a lot of the times people don't respect that, but I know definitely, because I've known you and Gabe for a really long time now, and you've known us mm-hmm. for a while, that has never been something that within our relationship that we is a problem, and that we respect that mm-hmm. more than anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people have a hard time respecting that because they don't know that the roots of a relationship right. never have anything to do with race.
Right.
And if that is, then the relationship you're in is probably not the one you should be in, right. you know?
And it's like, so it's problematic when it is based in race, because then mm-hmm. it becomes objectification. But, like,
yeah.
the roots of any relationship should be respect, like mutual respect and respect for your culture. And I think that, you know, me being the white one in the relationship, I think that the burden mm-hmm. is more on us to educate ourselves and learn about mm-hmm. the complex issues that the world sees when they look at us versus yeah. just like when we walk down the street, so that like Gabe and I want kids. I want to be able to have answers to the questions that they have with their mixed identity yeah. without having that experience myself. So mm-hmm. it's like,
and you know, you that with whatever your relationship, that you can absolutely, you know, be with your children, you can explain to them and educate them on both of their cultures mm-hmm. and where they both come from, totally. As at the same time as respecting the people who find interracial relationships a problem. Like, right. it's okay to respect their view,
yes.
and also be like, but this is how I'm going to do or how I'm going to educate my children yeah. and how I'm going to progress my relationship mm-hmm. without, you know, further disrespecting anything. You can still respect
exactly.
it for what it is.
Exactly. Yeah. And like this case is an example of, there have been interracial and mixed people forever.
Yeah. Forever.
So forever. To feel and pretend like it's a new thing, or like for society yeah. to be like, we don't have the tools to like deal with this. That's bullshit. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah. whatever. I'm going to read one more mm-hmm. of these
okay.
things that is thematic, but L. Okay. Collins from Atlanta, Georgia says, "It is too bad that Mrs. McCollum was exposed to the life she was living. Colored women have been mixing up with white men and every other kind of man all through history and are still doing it every day somewhere in the USA. She just got caught. Mm-hmm. So what? She was committing adultery and getting away with it, and then she broke another commandment. She killed. That's what tripped her up. We all have to pay for temptations. Let that be a lesson to us all. We all sin." So this is yeah. very victim blaming, and I don't agree with that part of it, but I do agree no. with the fact that it's like the pressure that she was feeling from like being a mother to a mixed child, and like that public humiliation should mm-hmm. not have existed. She shouldn't have been raped, yeah. but it also, no. you should not feel shame for your yeah. who your children are.
And it's just like the fact that people are passing judgment and they are putting her under this, you know, spotlight of like, these are the things that you've done wrong. Mm-hmm. I love the piece where she's just like, we all sin, mm-hmm. and we all do something wrong. Just, and this goes back to, like, you know, I grew up Christian. I still am Christian. I believe that, you know, wholeheartedly. And, but the thing that I was taught as a kid is, like, or now, even as an adult, is that sin is sin. There is no mm-hmm. level in sin. Like, murder and committing adultery, yeah, they're horrible. They're horrible things to do. But there is no level as
That's
to
so interesting.
What you're doing wrong and what they're doing wrong.
In Catholicism, we are taught that there are levels.
Really?
And some sins are worse than others. Like capital... I don't remember. Capital sin? No, capital punishment. I don't remember what they're called. But we're taught that there are levels, so that's interesting.
Wow, that's
but
interesting.
The baseline is that we're all sinners.
Yeah. Yeah. And that at the end of the day, regardless, like what I was taught is that on judgment day, mm-hmm. regardless of what you've done, mm-hmm. it's still sin.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that putting her, just because she got caught sinning doesn't mean she didn't sin. And just because right. she was caught sinning doesn't mean that she should die
right.
for those sins.
And you, just because you didn't get caught doesn't mean you didn't do it. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. And she definitely shouldn't die by the hand of man.
No.
Because they have a problem with the situation that she was in, whether she was
and
put in that situation voluntarily.
It before they even did the fucking trial. That's the thing that just
yeah.
kills me. Mm-hmm.
Like, why did they even have a trial?
Honestly, because they had to. Like, they couldn't,
yeah.
they couldn't, like, get away with it that bad. But that column is like the old Twitter, you know? That's what I kept yeah. thinking. It's like, oh, these are like old-timey tweets.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to Ruby after that very mm-hmm. deep segue.
Yeah.
So her conviction has been overturned. And before the second trial, her lawyer, Frank Cannon, arranged for Ruby to have a psychiatric examination in jail where she had been held for 2 years. So Dr. Dillard Workman, who was Ruby's original physician and Dr. Adams's campaign buddy, was and who did Dr. Adams's autopsy, examined Ruby and declared her mentally unfit to stand trial again.
Mm.
So, like, still beyond the grave, Dr. Adams has his, like, finger in every pot of this. But Ruby was committed to Florida State Hospital for mental patients. I wonder if that wasn't a small kindness from Dr. Workman, because there's mm-hmm. no way that Ruby would have been found not guilty.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, like, a mental home is in, like, 1950 whatever is a good place to be by any mm-hmm. stretch of the imagination. I took a class in college where we read History of Madness by Michel Foucault, and it was basically all about psych wards and the history of mental institutions. Oh my god.
Oh no.
Horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do wonder if it's like if he knew her before all this. Mm-hmm. He was kind of around, and I hope that it was a small kindness and not
yeah.
trying to
and
sabotage her.
I feel like he might have thought that being in a mental institution or be, you know, giving her as much help as possible
right.
was better than death.
Right. Yeah.
Because that's what would have happened to her if she did a second trial. Right. Like they would have
just
killed her.
Found the same thing. So.
Yeah.
So. In 1954, Ruby was committed to the mental hospital. She was released in 1974 when a new law passed that said that... I'm trying to remember. I didn't write it down. A new law passed that said that mental patients who were not a danger to themselves or others could be released. So mm-hmm. Frank Cannon, her lawyer from 20 years previously, free of charge, fought for her and got her released when this new act passed.
How old was she? So it was
1974, and she was born in 1909, so she was in her 60s at that point.
Okay.
Ruby lived in a rest home in Silver Springs, Florida, which after her release, which was funded by a trust set up by author William Bradford Huey. spelled H-U-I-E. I don't actually know how to say that.
Okay.
He paid her $40,000 for movie rights because he wanted to make an adaptation about his book about this case titled Ruby McCollum, Woman in the Suwannee Jail.
Okay.
The book and the movie that came out portrayed her as, like, a vixen and a femme fatale and, like, a willing participant. Mm. So, not accurate.
Yeah.
After her release, Ruby had no recollection of the murder at all, which a lot of people assumed meant that while she was in the mental institution, she underwent electroshock therapy.
Yeah, shock therapy. Yeah. Oh, no.
Right. But she was just happy to see her kids again. But she was released in 1974, and in 1975, Sam Jr., her firstborn, was convicted on 10 counts of gambling, like his dad. And the FBI...
Oh, no.
Yeah. And he went to jail, and the FBI confiscated $250,000 from the McCollum homestead, which later they like gave some of it back to him and everything. Sonia and Kay had both gotten married at that time, but Kay died in a car accident in 1978 and Sonia died of a heart attack in 1979. And then on May 23rd, 1992, Ruby died of a stroke at the age of 82.
Wow.
And she's buried next to her younger brother behind the Hopewell Baptist Church in Live Oak, Florida. Sam Jr. died in 2015 at the age of 81, and he, for the rest of his life, lived in that big 9-room house, which had fallen into a state of disrepair. But upon his death, his son Marlon Ivy announced that he had plans to restore it.
Good.
Yeah. And
it was her dream house.
I know. Marlon, who's Ruby's grandson.
I have the chills.
I know. I know. Marlon is Ruby's grandson, and he still lives in Live Oak and runs a funeral home like his grandfather and owns it too. Yeah. And has a bail bonds business because his connection to
Jack of all trades.
there's a lot of grandkids. I found some of them on Facebook.
Oh really?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
But there's a lot of grandkids, a lot of great grandkids who would be about our age in their 20s. But they all seem very enterprising and very business minded, like Sam, original Sam and Ruby. And they all still live in the South, mostly in Florida and Georgia. But the case has gotten a lot of attention, both when it was happening and recently, as we have dived more into racial, you know, tension in the country and learning about things and being examined under like a new modern light. And Sam Jr. was featured in a documentary about this that was made after reading Huey's book and just seeing like just how horribly portrayed Ruby was and how it was just not accurate at all. And so he got to talk about his mom, which I didn't get a chance to watch it, but I think it must have been therapeutic for him to like be able to say, because he was in college, he was at UCLA when this happened, to be able to like say something about his mom and like what she actually went through. So I want to end with a Zora Neale Hurston quote, because of course, but she says, whatever her final destiny may be, she has not come to the bar craven and whimpering. She has been sturdy and strong, a woman who ruled the lives and fate of two strong men, one white, the other colored. She had dared defy the proud tradition of the Old South openly, and she awaits her fate with courage and dignity.
This episode was written by Devin Balsamo Gillis
and edited by Asia Hamilton,
with music by Holly Amber Church.
For pictures and sources, please follow us on Instagram at DNA_podcast.
Please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast.
You can download it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. See you next time.